28. Philip lost any doubt that the chasm ahead was the chasm of certain doom when the straight-line route they'd been walking slowly changed to a marked path, paved with what appeared to be bones. Philip was convinced, but that didn't stop the chasm from trying to convince him further. The closer they got to the chasm, the louder it seemed to shout, "Certain doom!" After the path of bones, the next sign was the odor. They made a game of trying to describe what it smelled like, and settled on somebody cooking rotten eggs and broccoli in a microwave. A while later, they started hearing the sound. At first, they thought it was a waterfall, but it was way too uneven. When they finally drew close enough to actually look down into the chasm, they saw what the noise was. But by then, they were too distracted by the final, clinching proof that this was the chasm of certain doom. The sight of it. The chasm was deep. Grand Canyon deep. It was easily a mile to the bottom, and at least 4 miles across. The canyon walls dropped at an alarming angle to the dark recesses of the canyon floor. It was midday, and the sun was directly overhead, yet it was dark down there. It was as if the light from the sun could get to the bottom of the chasm, but it didn't want to. Philip couldn't blame it. They would have been looking down into a featureless black morass if it wasn't for the light cast by the river at the bottom of the chasm, which, instead of water, flowed with glowing lava. The four men stood at the edge of the chasm, looking down, joylessly.
"That wouldn't work," Tyler said. "A river of lava wouldn't cut a chasm like this. If anything, it would add rock."
Nobody bothered to agree or disagree. Whether the chasm made any sense or not, it was there, and they'd have to deal with it. Foul-smelling wind blew up from the interior, strong enough to make the remaining tail on Philip's abused fur coat flap like a plastic pennant. Waves of heat and thick dark smoke radiated from the lava, obscuring geological features that, ironically, were only visible because of the light the lava also emitted. What little they could see, they wished they couldn't. The flowing torrent of liquid rock flowed around islands of jagged stones and knife-like spires of glistening black rock. They had no idea how they would traverse the bottom of the chasm, but they knew how they would get down there to try. The bone path had led them directly to the cliff, where it made a 90-degree turn to the left and started a zigzagging path down the wall. The path was narrow. It made the single-file path they'd taken over Cardew Pass seem like a freeway in comparison. Gary asked,
"So, what do we do?"
If he'd been looking at Philip, the question would have been straightforward enough. But he looked squarely at Jimmy as he asked. The note containing Jimmy's thoughts on their predicament had fully made the rounds, and nobody had any objections, or at least any better ideas. He had asked what they would do, but by directing it to Jimmy, in essence, he had said, "I know what we're supposed to do, but what are we really going to do?" Jimmy got the message loud and clear. He peered down at the path. He looked along the cliff's edge to the left as far as his eye could see, then did the same to the right. He looked at the path behind them for anything that might be of use. All he saw was desert and a tiny dust devil way far off in the distance. Nothing of any use there. He turned to Philip, who had been studying the situation as well. Philip shrugged. Jimmy said,
"We go down the path, Gary. I don't see any other choice."
They spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out how they would carry the blade on such a narrow path. Their standard method of splitting the load and the danger between three of them would not work. They briefly considered just throwing it down like a frisbee and retrieving what was left of it when they reached the bottom, but they remembered Inchgower's admonition that the blade must still be in good shape when they arrived. The idea of reaching the bottom of the chasm only to have some fictional character refuse to recognize the blade was not appealing. Climbing back up the cliff, walking back through the desert, going through all that with the blacksmith and the pumping and the spider again, none of them wanted that. They tried the path and found that the only way it could be comfortably traveled was to walk sideways, leaning back, as if they were walking on a high-rise building's window ledge. They ended up having three men scuttle side by side. The man in front and the man in back would pinch the circular blade, supporting as much weight as they could, but mainly adding control and stability. The man in the middle would hold his well-wrapped hand flat at just about throat height. The blade would rest on this hand, where the blade twisted. He had to hold it at throat height because if he held it any lower, the other two men could not assist him without crawling. The plan worked well, until they reached the first switchback. Coordinating a turn for three people carrying something is complex enough, but the path was so narrow and steep that simply maneuvering the blade around the corner was out of the question. Instead, each switchback would cause a tense ballet. Everyone, even Philip with his one good arm, would help move the blade through the switchback with a great deal of effort and insults. All were aware that to touch the blade's cutting edge meant pain at best, and slow, painful death at worst. Quick, painless death was somewhere in the middle. There were countless switchbacks between the cliff's edge and the canyon floor, and before long they had perfected their switchback technique, and their insults. The descent was tedious, terrifying, and irritating, a unique combination that Todd had mastered. The only moments of levity during the entire trip to the canyon floor came when they were attacked by a cliff wolf. They had been descending for less than a half hour when the wolf appeared. Like the desert, the cliff offered no cover to hide the fact that the wolf was materializing out of thin air. Philip saw it first and called out, "Wolf!" as was the protocol. He prepared to fend it off with his one good arm, which would be difficult while walking sideways while clinging to a cliff, but he'd find a way. The others were carrying that cursed blade, and Philip needed to do his part. As with every other wolf on every other part of their journey, the wolf spawned somewhere just off the path, then scanned for someone to attack. Unlike every other wolf on every other part of their journey, this wolf materialized on the side of a sheer cliff. It did materialize over part of the path, but it fell with enough force that it didn't so much land on the path as bounce off of it. First, the wolf didn't exist. Then it was falling. Then it was bouncing. Then it was falling again for quite some time. Then it didn't exist. If it had been a real wolf, it wouldn't have struck them funny. But it wasn't a real wolf, and it did strike them funny. Very much so. It helped that the wolves were so poorly designed and programmed. There was no barking or yelping or attempts to stay on the path. Just an angry wolf snarling all the way to the canyon floor. Wolves attacked several more times while they were on the cliff, and it never stopped being funny. Even the last time, when they were near the bottom and the wolf survived the fall and ran back up the path to attack, something about watching the wolf come all the way back up to where it had materialized in the first place made it that much funnier. By the time they reached the canyon floor, they had lost all track of time. They agreed it had been hours, but none would venture a guess how many. It was dark, but they were at the bottom of the chasm of certain doom. It was going to be dark down here. They had seen with their own eyes that even at midday it was dark. Acrid fumes from the river of molten rock obscured the sky. They knew it was late, but they didn't know how late. What they did know was that they needed to rest. The trip down had been strenuous in every way imaginable. They bedded down on the forsaken hunk of rock where the path ended. It was broad and flat and surrounded with moving liquid rock. The flow was just close enough to be uncomfortably warm without quite starting to burn. On the bright side, no campfire was necessary. Also, the bare patch of solid ground was littered with wolf jerky from all of the cliff wolves that had fallen to their deaths. Tyler volunteered for the first wolf watch while the others got some rest. Later, Tyler woke Jimmy. Gary relieved Jimmy, then Tyler took another turn. Everyone knew that Philip needed more rest, and that he would deny this if asked, so they simply chose to not give him the chance. There had been the usual escalating wolf attacks while they slept. They had all gotten pretty good at sleeping through the sound of a man fending off multiple wolves. They certainly didn't bother to wake each other over something as petty as anything less than 8 wolves. That's why Tyler was the only one who heard a horrible crashing sound coming from the cliff above. They all heard Tyler scream, which caused their lizard brains to take over. They scurried in every direction before even waking up enough to wonder why. They instinctively split their attention between making sure they didn't jump into the lava and looking behind them to see what they were getting away from. They all heard the horrific crashing noise and saw what made it, and suddenly they were wide awake.